Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Thank you for returning. We have this situation that I've been exploring on the podcast in which we're learning about how many ways information gets communicated across beings, some of it intentional, some of it not, some of it non-visible, such as heart rate variability and odors, as in episodes 31, 32, 33, and 36, and some of it as in actual behaviors, like we heard last week in episode 43, where dogs who wanted to appear peaceable, as in communicating non-verbally that they do not wish to fight, they look away and they lick their lips. And appeasement signals are an area that I'm going to continue to explore on the podcast because as mental health therapists, we need to be increasingly aware of all the factors that affect our patients. And a large portion of people seek psychotherapy because of difficulties in social relationships. And these nonverbal signals have a lot of implications for relationships. In this case, appeasement signals are a nonverbal way to suggest that one doesn't want a conflict. And I mentioned in the last episode that there are many ways humans display appeasement signals. And today I have a study that demonstrates that so we can start to see how this works in human relationships and then start to understand what it might mean if we want to intervene to support someone in developing more skills so that they could have more satisfying relationships. So the study is entitled Flustered and Faithful, Embarrassment as a Signal of Pro-Sociality. I'll say it one more time. Flustered and Faithful, Embarrassment as a Signal of Pro-Sociality. Published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology in 2012 by authors Feinberg, Willer, and Keltner. So the first thing I think to do is remind ourselves of some definitions and then introduce one from the authors, or at least how they conceptualize some of these terms. So an appeasement signal is a signal that a being, either a human, dog, horse. I even found a study that talks about lizards displaying appeasement signals. So this is not limited to mammals. But for today's study, it talks about humans. And they're discussing this idea that embarrassment is kind of how I'm thinking about it, like an application of an appeasement signal. Because they've already reviewed in this work the previous studies that, to their words, have documented that the human embarrassment display involves gaze aversion, smile controls and inhibition, downward and sideways head movements, and sometimes nervous face twitching and laughter, end quote. So they're reviewing other studies that have talked about embarrassment involving the display of gaze aversion, smile controls and inhibition, and downward and sideways head movements, and sometimes nervous face twitching and laughter. Doesn't this sound familiar to what the dogs do? The gaze aversion can also be termed looking away. And it's important to note here that authors are suggesting this combination of appeasement behaviors is what constitutes human embarrassment. So again, we can't make too many statements about dogs. And in the last study, the appeasement behavior was thought to demonstrate the dog's peaceableness. And here they're taking a combination of appeasement behaviors, this gaze aversion, smile controls and inhibition, head movements, nervous face touching and laughter, as that combination being previously documented as what humans do when they explain a sense of embarrassment. So it's sort of, that's what I mean when I say this is sort of an application of appeasement behaviors. There's a wide variety of them by species, and some of them are going to combine. And of course, in the human population, we can further study their meaning of that experience. And when these things combine for humans, they tend to reveal a feeling of embarrassment. And then the authors do something really interesting, and that is they interpret previous studies and are setting the direction for their own in looking at embarrassment as a nonverbal apology that hopefully, quote, reduces the likelihood of harsh judgment and aggression by other members of the social group. So what they're saying here is that their feeling is that embarrassment, quote, serves not only to ameliorate the social effects of mistakes and mishaps, but further serves as a signal of an individual's underlying pro-sociality and commitment to social relationships. Because their unique view that I found fascinating, and that is we wouldn't feel that sense of embarrassment if we weren't worried about what others are thinking. So it's kind of this, they call it an other-oriented pro-social disposition. So they've set up a multitude of studies. They have 5 just published in this one journal article because they really wanted to delineate all the ways that this could be misinterpreted and remove as many variables there as possible. And so they had, these researchers are out of the University of California at Berkeley. So most of the participants are graduate students. So there are a variety of settings and methodologies that they used to come to their conclusions. And the general sort of summary of how they set these experiments up is they had some students reveal an embarrassing moment. Some actually had an embarrassing moment, you know, like tripped or something. But for the most part, the participants were remembering an embarrassing moment and recounting that for the study. And then they had some assessments taken by the other participants, as well as the ones who are revealing these moments. And what they're trying to get at is what it's like for other people to hear someone, or in some cases, see someone have an embarrassing moment and how they react to that. And what's so counterintuitive, in other words, you wouldn't think to be the case. And if we've had embarrassing moments, which I know we all have, we just cringe at that moment that your face flushes red and you notice and other, you know that other people are noticing what just happened. Ironically, what this study demonstrates pretty clearly is that your response in that moment, you're having that flushed face, that emotional reaction to kind of wishing that whatever just happened hadn't happened, actually gives the other people in the social group who are witnessing you have this moment, it gives them a sense of more trust in you and more affiliation towards you. It's like the researchers suggest that this idea of your personal experience of kind of letting down a social norm, you know, accidentally passing gas is one of the examples they say, and sort of doing something that's socially not expected in the environment in which your social group operates, and having a reaction, sort of knowing that you just violated a social norm, and having an emotional display that suggests you are embarrassed about that, actually led to a pro-social, that's what they're calling embarrassment as a signal of pro-sociality. And there's another piece to this, and that is the people who actually showed the intense embarrassment they found also tend to be more pro-social. So they did some assessments on them where the participants filled out questionnaires and other things, and these scales or surveys were about their pro-social tendencies, and there was a correlation between someone who displayed these intense emotional reactions to being embarrassed as being more pro-social. And this, you know, within range, of course, within limits, makes the people observing that person actually feel more trust toward them and a willingness to affiliate, you know, wanting to have a social experience with that person after witnessing them have this embarrassing moment. I just think that's really worth underscoring because, you know, and the researchers point out here that we work so hard to be perfect and not make mistakes and, you know, avoid moments such as the ones this article is focused on. And yet, our reaction to that helps us have a better social bond with our social group. Amazing. It reminds me of this, again, we're going to come back to Winnicott's idea of good enough and the summary from a lot of different attachment research by Beebe and Lachman that I discussed in episode number 37, where they are reminding us all the time that it just takes a good enough person to be a good enough member of a social group. And the thing that tends to make relationships stronger is that repair. And in this way, we're seeing a repair as a nonverbal signal, and the repair kind of being the awareness of the need to get back within social norms as a member of a social group. And that, I think, is really important to underscore, you know, for ourselves, for our patients, for the world at large, perhaps, just because it's such a relief to know that, you know, our mistakes can be fixed and that relationships can get stronger as a result. I actually had a personal experience about this that I was reflecting on as I was preparing for this podcast episode. A long time ago, actually upwards of 2 decades ago, I had an experience where I was in a class and one of the other women in the class, we had just come back from lunch, I think, and everyone was sort of rushing back to class. This was in a big city in San Francisco, actually. And so, you know, we were all travelers there, and San Francisco is kind of a lot to handle when you first arrive. And so, you know, we had so much time for lunch and people were kind of rushing back. And so this woman, as we settled in after the break, was just going to open a can of soda and sort of, you know, discreetly pulled it out of her bag and set it on the desk and went to open it, and it exploded everywhere. I was sitting across from her and I felt so sorry for her because there was pop all over the desk. It was getting on the people she was sitting next to. It was all over her books that we were using for this class. And I remember watching her. I wanted to help her, but the instructors kind of went to help her. And, you know, I was sitting at the, on the other side of the room. So people next to her kind of helped. And I remember going up to her after a break because I thought the way she handled it was so classy. She was embarrassed, but she kind of really looked at the instructors and, you know, was hopeful they would just continue and that she could get past that moment. And she remains one of my best friends after all these years. That moment kind of opened a way for myself and others to talk to her on a break. And we have been in each other's worlds since that time. So apparently there's something to this research, at least in my own experience. I've been very lucky to be able to have good friends for a long time. And that is one that kind of started from a moment that's similar to the one in this research article. One other thing to note that these authors highlight, which I find really important, is the difference between embarrassment and shame. So they are just describing embarrassment and shame as physical behaviors, and you know what typically displays and how they differ. And they're suggesting, quote, with embarrassment, it involves moving the head to the side and smile inhibition. So you're trying not to smile when you move your head to the side. Whereas shame involves lowering the head straight down and more of a frown. Psychologically, there's some research and theories suggesting that shame happens at an earlier age. We learn to be shameful earlier, and then as we mature a little bit, we start feeling the experience of embarrassment. That's probably out of scope for today's discussion, but I think that's really important to note that our nonverbal signals are differentiated on that very subtle difference between embarrassment and shame. And you're kind of seeing it there, but embarrassment typically is something, from my own view, is I feel like, I think I have said this actually on the podcast as well. Embarrassing is something you can sense that I did something that was bad, whereas shame is typically something that is, I am bad. That's what some of my former instructors and supervisors have explained to me. And so I think it's relevant here because with the observing of another having an embarrassing moment, much like in my own example, you can kind of go up to that person and interact with them and help them, hopefully, or at least let them know that you're aware that they want to get past that embarrassing moment and they're receptive to that. Whereas someone in a shame response, it's a little more difficult to engage them in conversation because they're not as, from my experience, readily able to engage in a pro-social discussion when they're having an experience of shame. So I thought it was fascinating that these researchers highlighted an actual physically different display between those two experiences as well. So the last thing to highlight here is that the researchers are also reminding us that when we trust someone and we want to affiliate or interact with them, that this also often leads to cooperative behavior. And so we're sort of, you know, doing an A plus B plus C plus D equals E, F, G kind of thing, where there's a lot of factors at play. But if we're wanting to help our patients have more satisfying relationships, then these are some ways we can consider interacting and intervening in helping them kind of practice these skills, because I work with teenagers a lot, and that is a time in life where those embarrassing moments are pretty much near mortifying. And so being an adult who can remind them that time is longer, our time horizons are longer than the teenage years, helping them remember they will get through those moments, encouraging if they have an embarrassing moment in our offices, encouraging some discussion and reflection upon that are ways that we can start to intervene. And I think the most important part, though, is really starting to see what we see in our offices and how these behavior displays can start to be more easily picked up so that we know where and when to intervene to help someone have a real-time moment of this experience being transformed into something that's therapeutic and hopefully helpful to their larger therapy goals. In summary, what I talked about on this episode is the fact that there's an area of research called appeasement signals. And these signals go across species and at times are between species. Today's research focused on how they work in humans when we experience an embarrassing moment. What the authors of the study found is that when someone observes another person having an embarrassing moment and that person reacts with some emotion, either some emotions that display to the observer that the person feels embarrassed, that seems to signal to the observer that the embarrassed person wants to be part of the social group, has a commitment to following the expectations of the social group. And this observation increases trust and it increases the observer's interest in affiliating or interacting with the embarrassed person. Also, the embarrassed person tends to, by filling out their assessments, they revealed the embarrassed person tended to display more emotionally expressive reactions to being embarrassed in correlation with how pro-social they are as a person. So the more intense emotional displays tended to be positively correlated or associated with people who tend to be more pro-social. And what does this mean for us as mental health therapists? Well, for one thing, normalizing embarrassing moments is probably important because not only is it very normal to experience an embarrassing moment, but the way one handles it can engender stronger relationships inside the social group where they occur. And finding these moments and listening for them in our therapy offices can hopefully give us one more opportunity for intervention in supporting someone to develop better relationships. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.